Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Mind Escape. Are you ready?
Are you ready to escape your mind?
All right, folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 308 tonight. We have a special show. We actually, this will be kind of interesting. This is the most guests we've had on at one time, which is three. We have Alex, Brandon, and Cody on to discuss their documentary called Entheomagus, which basically looks at the origins of Mormonism and takes into account local entheogens and, you know, plants and stuff like that in the area. I actually watched it. They gave me an early look. I loved it. I think it'll be very interesting to people that like that kind of stuff, and which are all of you nerds out there listening to the show right now. So, but yeah, looking forward to it. And before we get started, if you want to support Mind Escape, the best way to do that is to click the Linktree link down below. And yeah, there's plenty of stuff on there. Patreon, we've got, watch our documentary, check out our documentary, As Within, So Without, From UFOs to DMT, which kind of is a, I guess, adjacent in a way to your documentary, in the sense that, like, it looks at metaphysics and the possible origins of the ideas of metaphysics and things like that. So go check that out, and yeah, leave us a nice review if you like what we're doing. So, yeah, so without further, ado, Alex, Brandon, and Cody, I don't know who wants to go first, but why don't you give us some information first on when your documentary will be airing or playing, and then we'll go from there.
Sure, I'll step in and do that. So I'm Brandon. I'm the director of Entheomagus and co-producer with Cody. And Alex is one of the key researchers that appears in the documentary along with Cody, who's also on screen and interviewed in the documentary. So Entheomagus is, as it exists right now, it's a 40-minute documentary that unveils the psychedelic origins of Mormonism. And so this is a topic that was, the first paper was published on this in 2007, when psychedelics were a bad word in society in general. And 10 years later, Cody and another researcher who appears in the documentary, his name's Bryce Blankenagel, they appeared, they've made a follow-up paper to that. And so largely this work is the basis for the documentary. And we have screenings in Salt Lake City at the end of the month, April 27th, 28th, and 29th. You can get free tickets on our website, searstonedproductions.com, searstonedproductions.com. And then we have another screening in Portland, Oregon, May 11th, and that's a Saturday. So April 27th through 29th in Salt Lake, and there are six different options, and then May 11th in Portland.
Do you have a format in mind when that happens? Are you guys trying to get it on a platform like a Netflix or an Amazon, or what's your goal there?
Well, the goal is, we've been tossing ideas about how do we make a mass distribution of this idea? How would we get this out there to the public? Because it's such a wild idea. And Cody and I have been tossing ideas around, and we looked at the idea of doing a scripted series. We tried pitching it a couple times, and then thought that if we create a documentary, then we can use this as a proof of concept to pitch our scripted series, or potentially make a documentary series from there. So this is a something that we did on our is a passion project for now, with the intention of turning it into something bigger that would be on a streaming service. So that's what we're looking for, is connections to a streaming service or an agent that could help us get in the door.
No, I was just curious because we had to try and figure that on the go when we did our documentary, and we ended up, you know, there was some options to try and monetize it, but just, I'm just like, let's just put this on YouTube. It's our first documentary. You know, we did do a Patreon thing, like a director's cut where we didn't have any commercials and stuff like that. And we made a little bit of money off that. But yeah, I mean, the goal was just to get this thing out there and let people see it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in that same state. We're in the early stages right now, and we'll, you know, we're hoping we can get something bigger, you know.
No, I really liked it. I thought you guys did a great job. It's very well put together in the sense that, like, it's coherent. Like, when you watch through it, you learn it's not, like, weird pieced together kind of. Like, it's all kind of, you know, you go through the origins and then the thesis or the hypothesis, and then it kind of works off there. So, yeah, no, I thought you guys did an excellent job.
That's cool. Yeah, thank you. Not many non-Mormons have seen it, or people that have never been Mormon, I should say. And so it's nice to test it with other crowds. It's a tough thing to do because even if you're familiar with Mormonism, there's still so much education that you have to do on this topic, because Mormons, you know, it's very taboo. They don't participate in intoxicating substances at all, not even coffee. And so to be able to say you have psychedelic origins to your church, there's a whole lot of education that needs to happen. And then when you're talking to a crowd that doesn't have any experience in Mormonism, you've got to also educate them on Mormonism. And a lot of people don't have any understanding of psychedelics or Mormonism. So we've got to hit all of those people and try to educate them all on this subject in 40 minutes. It's a big undertaking. So I'm glad that you recognize the outline structure that we had there.
You did a great job, because I knew about, like, the basic origin story and the seer stone and a little bit of, like, the mysticism and stuff like that. But I didn't really know too much about, like, the actual origin stories of it and how it came to be. And I thought you did a good job with that. And I didn't know that much. I think the only other stuff I've really seen, I've known a couple people through working that were Mormon over the years. And then also my wife putting on, like, Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, which those ladies are drinking, and I don't think Mormons are supposed to drink, or, you know, they're out there getting hammered. So, so that was my exposure to that. And obviously we talk a lot about ancient psychedelic use and esoteric stuff and things like that on the show. So I thought that this was refreshing in the sense that I had never really thought about the connection there either. That's not something that I would have put together based on what I knew. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All three of us, you know, Alex, Cody, and I have different ways in which we discovered this topic of the possible psychedelic origins of Mormonism. There's overlap in how we all discovered it, but it is, like, really out there, especially considering the origin story that you're told with Mormonism, which I can give you a basic rundown of what you hear in church, what the Mormon missionaries, if they come to your house, what they're likely going to say. And I think from there, Alex and Cody can tell you this alternate history that we've uncovered, that shows the relationship that the early Mormons had psychedelics. And so the Mormon religion, and I use this word Mormon because there are many factions of Mormonism. The main faction of Mormonism is referred to as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it's headquartered in Utah. There are many other factions. All of them are smaller than that. Some are 100 or less people. Some are several thousand, up to maybe 100,000. But Utah is the main capital. Now, the origins of Mormonism goes back to a man named Joseph Smith, born in upstate New York, or born in Vermont, actually. But in upstate New York is where the origins of the church generally are. And when he was 14 years old in 1820, there was a massive religious awakening in his area. And he wanted to know which church he should join. And so he studied the Bible, he pondered a lot, and one day he comes across this verse that tells him that if he wants to gain wisdom, he should ask God. So he goes into this forest behind his house, prays, and lo and behold, he has a visitation from God the Father and Jesus Christ, who tell him that he shouldn't join any of the churches. And then in time, he has another visitation from an angel a few years later that tells him, hey, not far from your house, there is a golden record, a record written on golden plates, a book on golden plates that's buried in a hill by your house. You can go find it, and I'll be there and I'll show you where it is. Okay, so he goes there later. He finds this record, and he then, Mormons will tell you, by the power of God, translated it, and it became what is known as the Book of Mormon. That book became like the key factor in having people convert to the religion, a way to proof that Joseph Smith was a true prophet of God. He then organizes a church. There are further angelic visitations. Mormons then start to get persecuted, as Mormons like to say, and they move from place to place, and they go from New York to Ohio to Missouri to Illinois until Joseph is eventually killed, and the main faction goes out into the West and settles in what is now Utah. So that's the gist of Mormonism. It's then grown into a global church that claims the main faction, about 17 million members now, and is extremely powerful business-wise, politically, especially in the United States, but is a global power as well. But that's the gist of the Mormon story, the origin story that
outside the U.S., where is it the most popular, like outside of the U.S.?
Europe.
Outside of the U.S.?
Yeah.
What'd you say, Alex? Sorry.
Europe. Although supposedly the church has been growing very fast in Africa. My brother's on a mission in Ghana right now, actually, and they've baptized quite a few people out there. So it is growing pretty quick in Africa, too.
There was a statistic at one time that 1 in 20 people in Chile were Mormon and had been baptized Mormon. So were they practicing Mormons? Almost certainly no, but there's a huge Mormon population or a massive presence in certain countries in South America. People that at one point joined Mormonism but may not have stayed for long, but there is a large footprint in South America as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got a little history there. And I always like to go deep too, so I'll probably look more into the origins myself, because like I said, I knew nothing about this topic before, and some things definitely piqued my interest. And I think that our listeners are pretty savvy with this stuff. I mean, I don't, just because you look into stuff too, people are like, oh, it's, you know, why are you looking into that? I find it interesting. You know, don't you find it interesting that there's 17 million people that like would do anything for this cause or this religion that maybe don't even know about their own origins? And that goes for most religions, right? Like most people don't understand the origin of their own religion or whatever you want to call, you know, what they're into. So go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, this is one of the things I think we'll get into the course of conversation naturally, but like, you know, you've talked about how you've looked into ancient religions and their ties to psychedelics and ancient cultures and such, that the impetus for religion so often comes down to psychedelics. And one of the things with Mormonism that's unique is that it's a modern religion. We're talking 200 years old. And so you can look at Brian Mararescu's work and see that the Catholic Church is clearly tied to a psychedelic sacrament initially. That's 2000 years old. Okay. But if you look at Mormonism and you see a modern religion is tied to psychedelics, the implications of that are big. You can go from the most ancient religions to one of America's most modern religions, perhaps its most successful religion, and see that it's also tied to psychedelics. And that's one of the things that's just, for me, is like very attractive to see, like tying religion to psychedelics when religion generally.
I think the difference, though, if I may, between like Catholicism or Catholic or Christianity for that matter, between this and that, is like it seems like you guys are getting pushback from a majority of the people on this, where it seems like the immortality key or this idea, you know, was very romanticized a few years ago because of all the crazy and evil things that have happened in the Catholic. And I grew up Catholic, so it's not like I'm not speaking from a place of not knowing, but like, I think it's coming from very different places where people are trying to repackage Catholicism or Christianity and present it. And oh, it's like, oh, well, this actually was happening, and it seems like more romantic or more esoteric, and it adds like more value to it, as where it seems like you guys are onto something and you're getting pushback. I would say that that would be the dichotomy there.
Mormonism has a very polarized view of history. They've gone through several different revisions, several different historical reprograms or reboots, shall we say, that I would call maybe propaganda at this point in their history. So I think a lot of the reason why we get pushback, especially from mainstream members, is because, like you said, they don't know the origins of their own history. And you have to dig into sources that they would categorize as anti-Mormon a lot of the time in order to find a lot of that.
You talk to a lay Mormon and they're going to say that, oh no, Joseph didn't practice magic, or that was just a folly of his youth kind of thing. But I guess really that's where we should start if we're going to go deeper into the origins of Mormonism, which I do have to point out, church was founded on April 6th. So today, 194 years ago in 1830. So it's a good day to be talking about it.
All right. It's like the Friday the 13th of
Mormons also believe that Jesus Christ was born on April 6th. Another thing.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That actually might be, according to scholars, though. I think they say that it's probably a better chance that Jesus was born in the springtime based on what we know, you know, and then they switched it because of the pagan stuff. But
yeah.
Very interesting. Oh, my one question about the seer stone stuff. This is one thing, cause I mean, I know you talked a little bit about it, but like, I remember reading something on Druids and they had a similar thing. So like these, like this esoteric cult of Celtic people, you know, had these like things that they would look through and like rocks and stuff. So kind of like a similar vibe. And we know the Druids were very into the plants and the flora and fauna in the area and stuff like that. I was just curious if there was any connection to that or maybe where that came from.
Yeah. So there's some connection through that. I mean, we know Joseph had access to sources about the Celts. But the impetus of the original seer stone actually was from a teenage girl at the time. Her name was Sally Chase, who had a seer stone, and basically inspired Joseph to go out and find his own kind of thing. But he really was pulling that from, I mean, all of these different traditions. Like Joseph, what links Mormonism especially to this show is, like, you know, Joseph saw himself as restoring all of the ancient religions. You know, he was sort of creating this amalgamation of the best parts of, you know, Egyptian mysticism and ritual, the Eleusinian mysteries, Masonry, Rosicrucianism. He was kind of taking bits and pieces of all of this and putting it into, you know, one unified whole of a church is what his goal was. And so as a teenager, you know, his family was heavily steeped in all of this magic and mysticism and stuff. And his brother Hiram went off to school at Dartmouth when he was a kid, where he was learning all about the Greek religions and from some of the best Greek scholars of the time in the United States, and was bringing this back and teaching Joseph it. And then as a kid, Joseph went down to Salem, which was a huge hub of resources and knowledge at the time. In fact, one of his cousins, through his uncle's wife's family, was the first female translator of Buddhist scripture in the United States. And she was huge into Swedenborgianism, which has a lot of parallels with Mormon theology and like a lot of the Doctrine and Covenants. One of the scriptures pulls from Swedenborg's ideas.
And very interesting. So we have the background on Mormonism. What was the first piece of evidence any of you found that connected psychedelics to Joseph or entheogens to the church? And from there, did the pieces just kind of fall into place, or like explain how that kind of came to be?
There's an era of the church that's kind of known as like the visionary period of Mormonism. And that's Joseph's era, where, you know, regularly during church services, Joseph would come to people and say, like, you're going to see Christ, or there's a famous temple dedication that they performed in Kirtland, where over 500 people all had a visionary experiences that lasted throughout the day and sometimes longer than that. And with Joseph's death, that period of Mormonism kind of died out, and it got very quiet and kind of Quakeristic. It's very like still small voice, like God speaks to you quietly, not in loud visionary experiences generally, and especially in groups. So I think I'm sorry Alex, where are you? You want to pick up where I'm at? I have to go deal with a child issue at the moment.
You're good. Oh, you're
yeah.
good.
Yeah, no worries. Visionary era, Joseph was able to, you know, produce these mass visions on demand for people. He would tell people, hey, you guys are going to have visions tomorrow. And then they would have visions.
You're good. Keep going. I just pulled it up so you can, you know.
Yeah, you're good. And so we kind of need, you know, a reason for, or an explanation for his ability to produce these visions on demand. And really that kind of leads us to psychedelics is, you know, a lot of the accounts even mimic, you know, both the physiological, emotional, and sort of spiritual side effects of psychedelic use. So we see these accounts where even people both within and without the church were assuming that the wine or the liquor that they were drinking was laced with something. There was actually an account from one sacrament meeting where an outsider, he was a doctor, was viewing the sacrament. His name was J.J. Moss. And he tried to steal a bottle of the sacramental wine to see if he could figure out what it was laced with. But he was unsuccessful, unfortunately, because that would have been great to hear his analysis of it. And so from, you know, taking a look at these visions, we kind of started looking more and more at the herbs that the Smith family was familiar with and his compatriots. He always had an experienced herbalist in the first presidency or right by his side. So he always had someone that if he himself didn't know how to use the herb, he had someone who did know how to use it. So then we kind of start to look at, you know, these different candidates for entheogenic usage. Cody, do you want to pick back up on that?
Yeah, sorry about that. I heard it screaming. I first came across this theory with Robert Beckstead's 2007 paper, where he was just kind of proposing the idea that, you know, within the context of a 19th century magic worldview, that drugs were just another vehicle for visionary experiences. And they were just kind of another tool in a magician's toolkit. And that Joseph probably would have used them and gave several examples of things he could have been using. When I found it initially, I started researching this because I wanted to prove him wrong. I thought it was too like narrow-minded or too narrow in scope. I kind of hand waved a bunch of the things he originally proposed, but the more I dug into his sources and, his presentation, there was actually meat there. And I hooked up with another researcher, Bryce Blankenagel, who we worked on another paper in 2017. We published at the Sunstone Symposium, that kind of advanced the theory and like, here's all the stuff we found. And this guy's actually onto something. And then recently, Alex has jumped on board and we've been working on some response papers to some Mormon historians who don't like what we're doing. And that's kind of where we found all this initially, or at least I did.
And there's a paper on all this that I'll add the link once we're done to the show notes where all of you can check it out. And it's really interesting. I wanted to ask, too, are any three of you or any of you Mormon or were Mormon?
Yeah, all three of us were Mormon.
Oh, okay. So that I didn't know. I just didn't know if it was like all outside research, but that makes sense. So is it, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like for me, like when I'm Catholic, the first psychedelic experience I had in high school, I'm like, there's something here. This is what I've been looking for in church and haven't found my whole life, basically. So was that something that kind of drove all of you, like, hey, you know, we were raised in this, but there's obviously something to it. This has very, you know, this is a good explanation probably for why this came to be.
Yeah.
I stumbled onto the theory because I was doing ketamine treatment for depression and anxiety, and I started having visions, and I was like, holy shit, like, these are the same type of visions that the early Mormons were having, like same content, same sort of imagery. And all of this makes like perfect sense now. Like, this is exactly what I've been looking for, kind of thing. And just dove right in. And I know Brandon and Cody are fairly similar.
Yeah. It's a similar story. Like in Alex, I mean, you were still in the church.
I was an active Mormon while I was doing it still. So,
I mean, for me, what happened was I discovered Terrence McKenna, and this is why I was still fully Mormon, and I listened to him and didn't know anything about him, really didn't know anything about psychedelics. This is about 10 years ago. And I, first time just somebody talked about psychedelics in the way Terrence McKenna does. And then, I was hooked, and I listened to him like so much over the course of a year, other people, Alan Watts and others, along the same subject lines. And I just realized so much of the language that they use, and this is why I was still a fully active Mormon, realized that so much of the language they used was similar to the language that the early Mormons used to describe their visionary experiences. And there was a particular phrase I heard one time, and I'm like, this is so Mormon. I've got to look this up to see if anybody's done any research on Joseph Smith potentially using psychedelics. So I hadn't touched any intoxicating substances in my life to that point, but I just realized through listening to McKenna how similar the experiences were to early Mormonism. And that's when I found this paper that we're talking about from Robert Beckstead. And then for me personally, once I found it and believed that Joseph Smith was using psychedelics in early Mormonism, in a strange way, that allowed me to give myself permission to explore them. And so I didn't have my first psychedelic experience until after I already believed that Joseph Smith was using psychedelics.
I was kind of outside of the Mormon sphere when I discovered it. I found it similarly, but maybe I was a little more disgruntled and I didn't want anything to do with it. But I remember I had to go through seminary, and I remember getting in trouble for asking too many questions about the visionary period of Mormonism and why it didn't happen anymore. But then I was like 18, 19, took LSD for the first time and had a full blown religious experience. I was like, this is what they were talking about. And like Alex, you're like, I, the imagery is stark. Like, this is what they were describing. It was a few years before I stumbled onto Beckstead's paper and started studying it seriously. But that initial experience, that it was palpable how similar the language was.
Yeah. Very interesting. Now what was available to them in the like at the very beginning, or when it was supposed that Joseph was doing or using psychoactive compounds, what was available to him in that area? And what's the thought on, was it a variety of things? Was it one compound in particular? Like, what was going on?
So we think it was a variety of things. The earliest things that he likely would have had access to or familiarity with were Amanita muscaria and Datura stramonium. There's actually reports that strongly suggest that his maternal grandfather, his mom, and his dad were all using all three of those substances, or both of those substances, during their life. And all just prior to Joseph's own first vision. And his own first vision has all of sort of the anticholinergic symptomology, like it lines up perfectly. So it's early on, those were probably the two main candidates. However, there also is psilocybin species that grows in the area, henbane, belladonna. Later on in Nauvoo, we think ergot was a possibility.
Mandrake.
mandrake.
Essentially, all of the hexing herbs.
Yeah, the tropane thing really gets me. I understand. Obviously, it's a psychoactive compound, but like, not pleasant at all. So,
well,
like,
not all the visions were pleasant.
No, I know, but I'm just saying. I just don't. I mean, I guess back then they didn't really have the knowledge of the compounds like as we do from like a breakdown standpoint, but yeah, I mean, even going back now, you always think like, oh, mushrooms, but like, no, the Romans were spiking their wine with tons of tropanes, and it was all tropanes all the way down pretty much. So,
yeah. So I think like Amanita muscaria is a particularly potent one that they would have used, especially early on. His mom, Lucy Mack, when they were living in Tunbridge, Vermont, she records this dream that she had that is almost identical to a ton of Amanita muscaria reports that I've seen. And a year and a half ago, I actually went back. I was doing research and went back and found the foundation of the house that they were living on. So we were on their property, and their old rock wall still standing. A few years ago, they did an archaeological dig at the Smith family homestead there, where they dug and found the foundation of the home. They did soil analysis where they found the exact species of hops that they were growing, because the Smiths were beer brewers, so they knew how to work with herbs. And like Lucy Mack Smith, she was known for having incredibly heady beer. Like, she was a master at it. But while we were there in September of 2022, and we walk across the street into the forest that was on their property, and there's just Amanita muscaria everywhere, just hundreds of them. So one of these days, I want to go back and do a soil analysis to see if we can find spores to prove that Amanita was on their property at the time that they were there, because we already figured out the species of hops that they were growing at the time. So that's one candidate that they for sure would have had, almost for sure would have had access
to. Weird thing you say that is, the one experience I did have with Amanita was only like a weird dream scenario. I mean, obviously they're more of like a hypnotic than they are. I mean, you know, be careful, anybody listening too. You gotta decarboxylate to get the ibotanic acid out and everything. So, so the one experience I did have was very dream heavy, and in that regard, I felt like, how could anybody have anything visionary from this? But I guess if you think about it from the dream standpoint, because it's not like psilocybin where, you know, you're having this transcendent experience, you know, in waking consciousness kind of a thing.
Yeah. There's one of the, and I have to qualify this. Okay. I'm not the researcher. I'm the director of the film. So we got two researchers in the room. If I'm stepping out of bounds in any way, please jump in. Okay. But this is one of the main books that Robert Beckstead, references in his paper, and it's Magic Mushrooms and Religion and Alchemy. And so Amanita, from my experience talking to psychedelic people, is one of the lesser used mushrooms or psychedelics of today. I have had some minor experiences with them. I've never dosed it properly to have a major experience or anything, and I had drastically different things that happened in the three times that I tried it, but nothing ever breakthrough visionary or anything like that. But for whatever reason, I mean, especially this author, his name's Clark Heinrich. The book is Magic Mushrooms and Religion and Alchemy. He's very high on this idea and talks about his personal experiences with Amanita muscaria and also all the research that he did with it. But one of the interesting things that he does in the end is that he details one of his personal experiences, which is he and a friend went to a cabin and just basically ate mushrooms. Like, that was their primary source of food for X number of hours. I think it was more than a day even. And then if I remember correctly, they also drank their own pee, because that was one of the keys to actually instigate the experience. But when they did that, they started reading the Bible. And then he starts talking about, and he's not a Christian, I don't think he is, Clark Heinrich. I think he's just reading a spiritual book or whatever, but they read the Bible and then they have a visionary experience that Robert Beckstead quotes in this first paper, because it is so similar to what happened to Joseph Smith in what Mormons refer to as the first vision. And so has an experience with the Father, you know, who then calls him by name and like recognizes him and gives him some sort of honor or whatever it is, says, I see you type experience. So this is, you know, one person's experience who is a researcher into Amanita. I've never had that experience myself. I've never come across somebody personally, but he's high on it.
Well, there is obviously the Siberian shamans, and some people conflate that with like Santa Claus. I don't think that that's true. I think that there's other origins for that, but I do think that there is a tribe in Siberia, and there's videos of like them drinking the reindeer's piss after the reindeer eats the Amanita. So that's real. Whether that's what activates it or not, or maybe it needs to pass through a kidney or a liver or something, I have no idea. But to your point, I mean, my experience, like I said, was very dream heavy. It was like a hypnotic feeling. It wasn't, I heard somebody say this, and I've never done Blue Lotus, but they said it was very akin to Blue Lotus, where it's kind of like just chill, you know, hypnotic-y, not really too much. It's not like, again, not like psilocybin or one of the classic 5-HT2A receptor psychedelics.
It seems less reliable from what I've read. Terrence McKenna wasn't keen on it either. I mean, from my personal experience, and I think the most I tried was 1.5 caps. And what did happen to me, and this was before I was very, very experienced in psychedelics at all. I hadn't even tried, I haven't had my true psilocybin trip yet. So it was like greatly experimental. And I tried it, I think it was the third time in about a week that I tried it, because I was in New Zealand at the time, and they just happened to be growing everywhere. They were all over the place. And so I tried them one night, and I fell asleep shortly after, which I think is common with people with Amanita. And then I woke up, and I felt like super invigorated. And I wasn't exercising at the time or anything. And I just like, I was like, man, I want to go outside and run. And it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's like, I want to go running. And I'm like, I can't go running right now. I don't even know where I am. I'm in New Zealand, middle of nowhere. And then I'm like, I'm just going to do push-ups. And I just like started doing push-ups. Like, and it just like get, because I had all this energy in me. And it's like, it felt beyond placebo. Now it may have been placebo. I don't think it was, because it was very abnormal for me to have that. And then I sat down and I wrote for like 3 hours straight, just like nonstop. And so that was my most potent Amanita experience, but I did not see Jesus Christ.
No, that's interesting. And you know, everybody is different. I mean, you could give 10 people the same dose of psilocybin, they'd all have, you know, drastically different experiences. Now, there is crossover sometimes, and there's like weird synchronicity things that happen if you dose with people and things like that. Maybe there's some sort of connection, but we're all different. We all have different biochemistry and breakdowns in our GI tracts and different things. So I agree with you about the Amanita, though. I feel like it's not... It's not as consistent as a lot of the other psychoactive compounds, especially mushrooms. So,
yeah. Well, I think we opened the possibility for this being any number of things, and I think it was probably even seasonal. Like, it was what was available, when was it available, how long was it available, how much did we harvest, and a lot of these guys were skilled enough at herbcraft that you could use a number of things to get the same result. And I think while a lot of these experiences are subjective, the ceremonial ritualistic aspect of how Joseph was administering these things plays a huge part in how he could orchestrate large numbers of people to have shared visionary experiences that were often precluded by like a sacrament ceremony where he was handing out what he called consecrated wine, which in, you know, occultism and esoteric circles, it often means it's laced with something. And then he would go on talking, the sermons would last, and, you know, like an hour, hour and a half into the ceremony, people start having visions. And then there's other times when they're in more private settings, and, you know, people are smoking things, they're doing anointing ceremonies with oil. There's a million vehicles that this could have been transmitted through at the time that Joseph was operating. And it's stark that all of these practices are no longer part of Mormonism. And that's also why they don't seem to have visions anymore, at least from my perspective.
Is there any written doctrines within the religion that, I mean, obviously they go by the Bible or whatever, but like, is there anything else that maybe would point to something that was written down about this stuff? Or
I would say often the Joseph had kind of a public personality and a private personality. He had things he would advocate publicly, and he would often do counter that privately. But he was very clever about how he'd word things. So, for example, the document, the Word of Wisdom, is a revelation that Joseph gave that kind of dictates Mormons' dietary restrictions. So that's why they today don't drink coffee or tea. But when Joseph originally gave it, there's a lot of legal wiggle room for what you can incorporate. He says, like, all herbs and plants under God are sanctioned by our use, as long as they're consecrated with an eye to God. So basically, if you like, anything's fair game.
There's another revelation that where Joseph is told by God to only use wine of his own make for the sacraments. So he was explicitly in charge, and whoever he put in charge of making the sacramental wine, which leaves it wide open, saying, hey, you can't bring in other wine. Like, you have to use this stuff that we are making for you.
What makes this, like, especially challenging for a Mormon today is that they're so much of their belief is centered around not taking these substances. And when I say these substances, I'm talking specifically alcohol, tobacco, drugs of any form, other than something prescribed to you by a doctor, which a lot of Mormons are kind of over medicated, but other forms of intoxications, coffee and tea, are specifically outlawed. And so also they don't use wine in their sacrament or communion anymore. They use water in a piece of bread. So there is no room for any intoxication in Mormonism. So if you're coming in and telling them in your early days, your visionary experiences were coming from what we now label as psychedelics, it's really challenging for people.
So when did that change? Like, was there one person leading the charge on this kind of like a prohibition on compounds, or how did that evolve?
So it died out with Joseph, because Joseph was the herbalist, and he had the people, he always had the herbalist on his, you know, as his right-hand man. And then he was killed off, and there was sort of this struggle for power within Mormonism, and it kind of schismed. And so the main church followed a guy named Brigham Young, where they essentially had to leave Nauvoo, Illinois, and that's when they did their pioneer trek out west. So in part, it died off because Brigham, A, wasn't as mystically minded as Joseph. He didn't give a damn about the visions like Joseph did. He was more interested in the economic side. And then they move west to a new locale, new plants, and so they were kind of essentially cut off of their original sources of the material. So that's really one of the biggest reasons it changed, is it went through a theological shift, so it was no longer okay to have these visionary experiences. Like, they explicitly link in an 1850 conference of the church, they explicitly link the older grand visions with apostates. And they say, oh, the real members, the strong members, they just have the, you know, the still small voice that Cody was talking about earlier. You know, they don't have these grand visions sort of thing. So it gets completely taken away, both theologically.
So what's the small voice? Is that, you mean like a inner dialogue or something? Like everybody has got like a inner voice, you know, like you consult with. Like, that's not like a special Mormon thing. They know that, right?
Mormons will tell you it is, though. That's the thing that testifies of truth.
Yeah, so throw up that Leonardo DiCaprio meme of him behind the camera laughing, you know, from Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. But like at the same time, it's just like so much of this stuff especially with religions, and not just Mormonism, like a lot of religions, it's just the same stuff. Like, most of these people don't know the origins of what they're believing in. Like, at very least, let's say you consider yourself a good Christian or a good Muslim or whatever, Mormon, whatever. Shouldn't you know, like, the ins and outs of where this came from? Like, from historically, too. Like, what archaeological evidence? Is there any archaeological evidence? Is there any linguistic evidence, text, like, things like that? Like, none of these people know any of that stuff. And it's, well,
the,
you know,
modern church actively suppresses its history and tells people not to study it. You know, you can only study it from the official sources, which is the church itself and, you know, its token apologists. And, you know, they kind of shy away and play down Joseph's treasure digging, you know, his magical practices, the fact that, you know, the temple ceremony, the main temple ceremony for Mormons, is pulled from Masonry. Like, in the 90s, especially in the early 2000s, there was one of the head church leaders who basically went after all of the divergent Mormon historians and theologians and excommunicated all of them. You know, the guy who did the groundbreaking work on Mormonism and magic, they excommunicated him. They excommunicated a bunch of people talking about, you know, Heavenly Mother, the idea that God was married and, you know, we should be worshiping both Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, excommunicated them. And so
it's so funny you say that. I was just cutting up a clip of, I did an episode with cannabis historian Chris Bennett, and we were talking about Telerad and the temple in early Judaism where they found cannabis resin, and they had two standing stones, one for God the Father and one for, I think, Asherah, the mother goddess. And I think in the museum they took the mother goddess out, so it's just the one. So it's like, what are we doing here? We're trying to, like, revise history. Like, no, we come from, I mean, aside from Akhenaten, everything's pretty much polytheistic, you know. So I don't know.
Well, in Mormonism specifically, you have this issue that there's not just, you know, an evolution in how the history is presented, but, like, even in Joseph's days, like, when he started the church, his attitude about psychedelics and visionary experiences was like, everybody should share this, we should give this to whoever wants it. And then that kind of didn't really work out so great, and the PR was getting bad, so he revised that. Now it's like, okay, now only in the sacrament ceremonies, only for members only. And even that didn't seem to work out so great for him. So it got it, like, okay, only in the school of the prophets when we're in with our inner circle. And then it evolved to, okay, we're going to build a temple and we're going to have these secret special ceremonies that we're only going to do for people that are worthy enough to be in the temple. So even if you're Mormon, you have to be this certain kind of Mormon to be able to have access to these things. So there's an evolution of, like, who had access to these ceremonies within Joseph's lifetime. And then, like Alex was talking about, he dies, there's this church schism, everybody kind of starts practicing their own version of Mormonism. And we have to trace these histories each time it schisms, each time it changes. So this process of uncovering this information is very long and very tedious. And it's like, in the deepest weeds you can possibly get in Mormon history, which is why it's taken so long to kind of uncover all this.
Have you guys shown this to anybody that's still a practicing, like, devout Mormon, and what did they have to, what was their feedback on it?
Yeah, I mean, I've shown it to my oldest sister, who, there's six kids in my family, and she's probably the most hardcore Mormon amongst the six. And but what's interesting is that Mormons are, like, big into essential oils, and they're big into, like, homeopathy, and she was into that stuff, and I'm like, in her studying of that, because she went to school to study it, it's like, she had to have come across psychedelics, she must have. And I talked to her about it one time and she didn't, and that was still, she went in a time when psychedelics weren't as mainstream as they are right now. But I'm like, well, since she did that, she might be open to this idea. So I had a couple conversations with her, like, there were probably about 2 hours each, where I talked about this topic with her, and she was actually very open to it, which was pretty shocking to me, because Mormons generally do not like to be challenged in things that are like very wayward from their normal belief system. And so I showed her the documentary, and she was very open to it afterwards. She told me the two things she was offended by in it. I told her before she watched it, I said, if you stop watching it, tell me exactly where you stop, because I want to know where it is that you get uncomfortable and see if we can perhaps address that or consider addressing it, do it differently. She got through the whole thing. She was offended by one thing that happened in the closing credits, and she was offended in the last shot before the closing credits. And but we've been able to have probably four or five more than 60-minute conversations about this topic as a result of my involvement in the documentary, and she is very straight-laced Mormon. So I don't know if she's eventually going to try psychedelics, but she is at the point where she's at least like open to that conversation, which is pretty shocking to me.
No, that's awesome. I mean, look, we've talked with a lot of, you know, we've talked about a lot of dogmatic people. We've done this show now for over 6 years within these fringe communities and religions and psychedelics and all this different stuff. And, you know, everybody is very protective over their community. One thing I will say, though, is we're all human beings, too. I think we all deep down love a good mystery and like do want to unfold like what the truth is of the matter. But there is this weird thing, which I will say, which I had like a spiritual experience, like an awakening or whatever, a reawakening like 7 years ago. And I've talked about it on the podcast and stuff. And that's kind of what led us to do the podcast. And I was very into like a lot of woo things. And through that process, I've whittled it down. I'm like, oh, so like most of that was bullshit. There is some interesting aspects to these things. Then maybe I can see what this true fringe is all about. But until you get on that path, you don't know. And I think that with what we see in society right now, a lot of people abandoning religion, and you see people need that hole filled. And you can even go back to Plato's dialogues where I think Socrates is talking about how you need a higher order or a higher power to believe in, or else things start to decay. You become an immoral person. So I think that if you can offer these explanations, like you with your sister and this documentary, and just having these open-minded conversations on these things, I think we can get to a place where it's like, maybe you can keep some of these traditions or these rituals or whatever with the understanding of how it got there without all the dogma and the controlling and all that kind of stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of funny. There's a mushroom church that started here in Utah by a couple ex-Mormons, Steve and Sarah Urquhart. It's called the Divine Assembly. And it's basically this giant group of ex-Mormons who have all found psychedelics and get together and we talk about it and whatnot. And the one tenet of the church is, you know, everybody can access the divine on their own terms, sort of thing, using the sacrament, of course, psilocybin. But it's really fun to sort of see all of these people kind of come together and be like, all right, yeah, we're trying to make sense of these experiences. We're trying to understand it. And the majority of us all come from the same Mormon background where it's very strict, very dogmatic. And we're kind of trying to play around with, okay, well, what does it look like to, you know, think about these experiences non-dogmatically, to look at our history non-dogmatically. And so it's this really kind of cool little counterculture that's developed in Utah based around psychedelics.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you see that now. I've seen people combine Christianity and psychedelics, people tapping into the ancient Soma or Homa and the psychedelic rituals and stuff like that. One thing I always question too is like the people that don't question it, like what are you doing? Like you're not... You think these people experience some sort of magic, just these few people, some magical shit happened that's never happened again in the history of the world, and those are the people that experience it, and only them are that blessed, and it'll never happen again, and you're just supposed to just believe it? Like, from a logic and a reason standpoint, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, go ahead, Cody, sorry.
I think there's this knee-jerk reaction people get by the idea of us like trying to understand how these things worked, or like trying to replicate them is almost like an act of blasphemy, rather than understanding where it's just like a matter of perspective. It's like, we're worshiping the same as you. I just want to know how it works, and I want to be able to replicate it. And some people, just the very act that you're trying to understand it is in itself like offensive. Like you said, it's like, how dare you try to figure that out? This was just for them.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting too is, you know, Mormons seem very attached to this idea that it's all on God's terms. Like, we have no say really in our relationship to God other than being obedient and following all these rules. And, you know, if we are, and we're lucky enough, you know, God might give us these breadcrumb experiences. Oh, he helped me find my keys. Oh, you know, something like that. Whereas, like, the way Joseph understood it early on, and the way, you know, even we're trying to navigate this, is like, no, it's a relationship with God. You know, there's this two-way street between you and the divine, and you have some say in how these experiences go and whether or not you have them, you know. And psychedelics are sort of a way that we can work through that and have this two-way street. And that, for a lot of Mormons, is really hard to swallow, because, you know, they're so, I don't want to say brainwashed, but kind of brainwashed to go that, oh, only, you know, the people with authority above you can receive revelation.
I mean, you don't even need to bring, I mean, I understand that's what we're talking about, but you don't even need to invoke psychedelic stuff. You could just say meditation versus prayer, because the way I look at it is meditation's kind of like a two-way, you know, thing happening, as opposed to prayer, which is like, oh, please help me, you know, I need your help, and, you know, blah blah blah. And it just seems like needy and what are you doing kind of a thing. I mean, I get it, and some people have crazy mystical experiences after they do that when they actually really do need that. So, I mean, I'm not like one to poo-poo anything, but I will say that I don't like dogmatism on any side, whether it's religious, non-religious. I mean, even science, you know, scientism is a real thing too. So it's like, I'm all about balance. Let's balance out what we know. Like, is it possible to know some of these things? Cool. Well, what would be a reasonable explanation for why these people experienced these mystical and metaphysical things that anybody else in day-to-day consciousness isn't experiencing, unless maybe they have like schizophrenia or some sort of chemical imbalance, you know? And that's a whole different story. So, but from that standpoint, it's just, again, I don't understand how more people aren't curious, and then they get defensive about it without actually even knowing anything about it.
You know, something that's interesting, another sister of mine, my second oldest sibling, she's left Mormonism as well. But one of the things that kept her in for probably longer than was necessary, if that's the right word, was that she couldn't explain why the early church members were having such visionary experiences. She felt like she was doing something bad against her ancestors by leaving the church. That's how she viewed this. Like, these people were so important that God gave them visionary experiences. I think that that's how some people view it, that like, this was such a special time in history and it's not going to happen again. And if you leave, you're doing a disservice to your ancestors. And I think that that played in my sister. And it was actually through conversations with her when this her leaving the faith was when it wasn't as involved in the research.
And that's sad. That's sad that she felt that way, and like isolated, and something that should have been like propping her up or giving her community and a good feeling. Like that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's the kind of stuff. It's just like, you know, that shame. It's like, am I not doing that right? And as I mentioned earlier, I kind of felt that way growing up, you know, being Catholic and going to Catholic schools at an early age and stuff, and going to church multiple times a week. Like, I never, like, oh, this is like a chore. It's not even doing anything for it. And how are we right and all these other people are wrong? That doesn't, I started thinking about that when I was like 11 years old too. Like, this doesn't make any sense. But we're all starting from different places. And I mean, it's good that your sister sounds like she found her way on that. And, you have to do what's right for you. And some people thrive at having some sort of direction or, you know, they need that thing, whatever, that's that sky daddy to fall back on, you know? I mean, look, that's real, by the way, because when I forgot to mention this, when I was going through my spiritual awakening, I was believing more in like one higher energy power type thing, and it gave me a lot of peace and comfort. And I have bad OCD, anybody that watches the show, so it's like, that's another reason why I've used psychedelics in the past. So it's like, there is something to that where you cannot replicate it through anything else. That feeling of like, oh, somebody else has got me kind of a thing is very intoxicating. And on one end of it, I do kind of see if, okay, so maybe that offers those people comfort, but from like I said, a reason and logic standpoint, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, I mean, another thing with this, and we've kind of like hit on it a few different ways and talking so far, is that like it, you could look at our documentary and it's like, what is the intent behind this? Why did they make this? Are they trying to destroy Mormonism? Are they trying to tell me that my faith is invalid? Are they telling me the church is bad or anything like that? And it's like, we make this very clear, especially in the second to last scene where there's a roundtable discussion with the three main researchers, where, there are many ways to explain what was happening in early Mormonism. People are going to take it in different ways. If they take this entheogen theory seriously, oh, Joseph Smith was just, drugging the people without them knowing it. And it's like, sure, you can say that. But it's also like, if you use plant medicines yourself or entheogens, it's pretty hard to say, just dismiss it away. You know, it's to say there's something there after you have it is not a long shot, you know? And so to then work with entheogens and see like, maybe they were using this in early Mormonism. And if they were, maybe I should try this too. And maybe it will help redefine my faith and my relationship with the divine. And that's what more of this is. It's just giving people another tool to connect and empower themselves, as opposed to going on and with the faith as it is. This is just something else that you can do to develop your relationship with the divine, and just like they were in early Mormonism.
Another point I want to make. Oh,
yeah, go ahead,
Mike.
Okay. No, I was just going to give you a compliment. Like, from watching the documentary, I didn't get any vibes of like you shitting on Mormonism or taking shots at it or belittling it. I didn't get any of that. And in fact, that's why I asked you if you guys were in one, because I didn't know what to expect from this conversation. I thought maybe one of you was still in or not in. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's just like, it's pretty ambiguous from that standpoint. So I wouldn't be worried that, I guess I shouldn't say that because I'm not coming from Mormonism, but as an outsider watching it, I didn't get the vibes that you were like selling it or anything. You're just giving like a breakdown of like the history and then these connections that you felt like were important to its history, if that makes sense.
That's good to hear. Yeah.
I like that. That's really nice to hear, especially from somebody that's not Mormon, actually. I really like that. Yeah.
Brandon, I wanted to make a point about, you were talking about, Joseph drugging the other people kind of thing, and they may or may not know. One thing I think is, like, Joseph understood himself to essentially be like a hierophant. You know, he was functioning in the same sort of way that the priests at the Temple of Eleusis were, you know, trying to facilitate this specific kind of experience in the people. So I think he kind of viewed his role as doing whatever was necessary to get people to that space. So I don't think there was any malintent on his part. You know, he was like, you know, I'm a hierophant. I'm supposed to give these visions to people. And this is one of the tools that I have that most reliably gives people this type of vision. And so really, you know, in his sense, it's an altruistic move of, hey, you know, if they're struggling to see the divine, let me aid them in that process kind of thing.
And that also brings up another point. Like, we are at no point trying to give a gotcha to Mormonism. We're not trying to, you know, dismember it by proving this theory. And that's also to say that, like,
yeah, right, Cody. Offline, you were saying, you're like, I'm Leah Remini, number two, Cody. Yeah, I'm coming.
Oh, you got me. And we're also not saying that like every visionary experience was precluded by psychedelics. Like, there were plenty of people and individuals who were doing this through prayer or meditation or singing hymns or whatever it was that was their jam. what we're really emphasizing is the times when Joseph told a congregation of people, like, you're going to see the Savior. And then he delivered that after delivering the sacrament. Like, those are the things we're trying. And, you know, it's, this is just another weird aspect to a very weird history. It's not, you know, we finally got him, guys.
It just sounds like he was an ancient American shaman, like, not like Native yeah. American, but just like an ancient American medicine person that connected that to Christianity. Is like, if you went off the descriptions you all gave or whatever, like, that's kind of how I would think about it. I wouldn't think about it as opposed to how I did think about it before, which was like this very like wackadoodle origin story, you know, like, and I'm not trying to be mean, just like, that's from an outsider, that's the perspective. And I feel that way about a lot of things, so it's not just this, but that's the vibe that I used to get. And now looking at this, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. And we've talked about that on this podcast, like I said, for the last 6 years, whether it be the Eleusinian mysteries or the, go back to any of the ancient mystery schools, Egyptian mystery schools, anything, there was definitely mind-altering things happening, whether it was deep meditation, psychedelics, entheogens, near-death experiences, you know, inducing these different states. Like, that's been happening forever. So to correlate that to what you're talking about is not that far of a stretch. I think that the disconnect is it's so much more recent than all those other ones that we don't really think about it like that. But I think that, you know, the work that you guys have done is great. I know P.D. Newman kind of looks into that time frame too, as well as like alchemy and stuff like that. And there's a lot of stuff happening there. So
there's a lot of crossover too. P.D. and I particularly, I've talked to them a number of times about this kind of thing. And the masonry alchemy aspect of this definitely crosses over with the Mormon side of that. They were all deeply embedded in that kind of esotericism.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Is there another thing, yeah, go ahead.
No, you first, Mike.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to shift a bit because I mean, at that time, you know, we have the Second Great Awakening happening and visions are a lot more common at the time than in other periods in, you know, American Christianity, especially. And one thing in favor of, you know, the psychedelic use of Mormons is even the people with crazy visions were like, holy shit, what are these Mormons doing? Like, they're wackadoo kind of thing. But I actually think that, you know, in the Second Great Awakening, psychedelic use was a lot more common than we realize, in part because of the medicines that they were using at the time. You know, I've been doing a lot of research into trying to understand, like, the uses of Datura and Belladonna at the time. And, you know, I've been canvassing all these medical textbooks from the late 17, early 1800s in the United States, and Datura is throughout all of them. Like, they were giving decently high doses of Datura to patients, you know, suffering with rheumatoid arthritis, epilepsy. It was supposed to help with allergies even. Like, all of these different things that Datura was being used for. So it's not that far of a reach to go, okay, you know, maybe this person who's suffering really badly from rheumatism, you know, they take their Datura medicine at night and they wake up and go to church first thing in the morning. They're predisposed to have these sorts of visions. Like, they're on a micro dose or whatever, or have been dosing it multiple times, you know, over the course of days or even months. They had like 3 month treatment courses with Datura for epilepsy at the time. Like, so these people are ingesting these psychoactive substances on a regular basis, you know, maybe the morning of going to church. And so maybe part of the reason, you know, there were all these visions, yes, it was cultural, yes, it was social, but maybe it was also because of the generalized medicine at the time, which would make, you know, Joseph's use of it not that strange, because he had doctors all around him all the time who were using these and who were studying cutting edge medicine.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, and it's definitely found everywhere, at least in the, you know, United States, East, Midwest, you know, all throughout there for sure. Yeah, again, the tropane thing's kind of, I mean, it's so prevalent, but it's just like, that's that can't be fun, right? I mean, like, are people going, like, looking for that darkness? You know, that's the kind of thing that I wonder.
Going for their shadow side.
Yeah, working on their shadow or entering the shadow or whatever. But I remember, too, like, who was it that we had on? Dr. Andrew Gallimore. And I was, because we were talking about the difference between, like, phenethylamines, tryptamines, and, like, tropanes. And it seems like whether, like, aside from like the value of is one better than, or is it, does one reveal more or whatever? It just seems like tropanes is more akin to like an actual vision of something that's not there, as opposed to a tryptamine, which you're looking at the wall and it's kind of moving a little, or the ground patterns flowing, or whatever the case may be, something that's more psilocybin based or LSD or DMT. But I just remember that conversation thinking that maybe that is the source of all the gods and goddesses, is the tropane stuff. Cause people are just, again, and maybe there's something to it that's metaphysical, that's manifesting in that way or whatever, but just using those compounds to induce those visions is something even more wild than what we know as modern psychedelics and those experiences, at least from my hundreds of experiences that I've had.
Yeah, well, and I mean, what's of particular note frequently in a lot of these Mormon visions is they're talking to people that aren't there, that, you know, only one or two or three sees. I mean, in these grand visions, you know, the temple dedication and stuff, a lot more people are seeing all these different people. But, you know, you read some of the visions that Joseph has, or that Joseph and one other person has, and it reads as like everybody's just sitting there watching him, and he and his fellow person are, you know, just talking to an angel, like, oh yeah, hey, Peter, James, and John are right here, and we're talking to him. Hey, Elijah's right here, and we're having a conversation with him, kind of thing. So, I mean, it lines up perfectly with, you know, seeing somebody that isn't there. It's just augmenting your reality a little bit.
Yeah, very interesting. And then you got the outlier, Salvia, but they would have had to go to, like, Hualta, Mexico to find that. It's like a very specific region.
I don't think so. I don't think
that was around back then. Yeah, it's a new world. Probably the Maya knew about it, but all right, so what are we missing here? Is there anything we didn't touch on yet that you, any one of you want to touch on that we didn't get to?
Cody, I think we should bring up Fred M.
I was just about to say, one of the most exciting and weirdest parts of this whole thing that I like to bring up is, so we talked about Joseph, this visionary period kind of died out, and the church schismed. One of the offshoots of this church was the Community of Christ, what's now called the Community of Christ, or the RLDS faction of the church. And they were kind of following a paternal bloodline. The next people in line to take over after Joseph were his son. And so Joseph Smith III took over the reorganized church, and his son, Fred M. Smith, who is Joseph's paternal grandson, was one of the first psychologists in the United States. He studied at Columbia. I think G. Stanley Hall was his mentor. He wrote a PhD dissertation on altered states of consciousness, specifically religious states of ecstasy, as he called it. And he was a huge peyote advocate. What's kind of ironic about all this is this history was lost, and Joseph's grandson unintentionally kind of picked it back up, because he was trying to find a source for how to replicate revelation in the way that his grandfather had. And he stumbles across peyote in the early 20th century. And as a psychologist and a standing Mormon prophet, he has a very interesting perspective on altered states of consciousness, and specifically religious states or religious rituals that induce these states. And so he, being a peyote advocate, was like sharing it with his friends and going to tribes that were associated with Mormon missionaries, and taking peyote ceremonies. he sent some peyote to his daughter, Alice, who was going to school at the time, and she didn't seem to like it very much, but she did have a friend, Virgil Thompson, who was going to Harvard, who was hanging around. And through one way or another, Fred M., her dad, and Virgil Thompson struck up a relationship, and he started giving peyote buttons to Virgil Thompson under the agreement that Virgil Thompson would give him like research data. He would basically give him, here's my anecdotal report from my experiences. But he liked it so much, he went back to Harvard and started sharing peyote with his other artistic, you know, musician friends. And they started the Harvard Aesthetics Club, that helped spread the use of peyote and, you know, help kick the beatnik movement and a number of other things. But what we don't know, or what's lost to kind of the birth of the psychedelic renaissance as we know it, is that this psilocybin project in the 1950s and 60s that kicked off the psychedelic renaissance was precluded by another psychedelic club at Harvard in the 1920s that was being funded peyote by a Mormon prophet. And this isn't speculative. This is, you know, this is all documented. Fred M. wrote a whole book where he has a chapter about how great peyote is.
We have the journals and the memoirs of Virgil Thompson, the daughter, talking about passing it around at Harvard. So, you know, the psychedelic renaissance started at Harvard just 40 years prior to when we think it started with Timothy Leary and whatnot.
And it was sparked by a Mormon prophet.
That's another one that grows in a very specific area, peyote, right on the border of Texas and Mexico. Actually, I think, from what I understand, that habitat's dwindling as well. So, I mean, obviously, we have the resources to, you know, replicate. There's tons of people growing San Pedro and peyote out there. But, yeah, it's still sad, right?
Yeah.
That's super interesting. And it's always Harvard involved with these psychedelic, right? But it doesn't surprise me that, I mean, I didn't know about that. That's actually pretty early, a lot earlier than I would have thought. But it doesn't surprise me at all. Do you think that that kind of stuff was getting around, like anything trading wise? Like, that's what I was going to ask you too, is like, would it have been something definitely local to Joseph, or could it have been things like, obviously forever things have been traded, so could it have been something that they got through trading? I mean, I would probably rule, well, I mean, cannabis, obviously the cannabis plants that grow are more hemp related at this point, or hemp variety naturally here to the Americas, but I think Cody had to pop out, which,
yeah,
shout out to Cody. No, thank you so much, Cody, if you're watching or listening to this later. We really appreciate your expertise and knowledge. So what do you think about
the last thing? Because there's a chance that Joseph Smith would have had access to peyote. He sent Mormon missionaries down to the Texas-Mexico border, where peyote is, one guy named Lyman White, and they brought stuff back to him, you know, from the Native Americans. So, and this is evidenced by, he had a stone that essentially looks like hollowed out peyote, essentially. And there's an image of it in the paper that I'll have you link to, The Entheogenic Origins of Mormonism, that's just fascinating. So there is a solid chance that Joseph, at some point or another, had access to peyote through either some sort of trade, but especially through these missionaries that he sent back down to Texas. And what's interesting is that the fellow that he sent down, Lyman White, was one of the guys who's had many visionary experiences in early Mormonism that were most likely psychedelic in nature. Like, that's a whole nother tangent. But after Joseph died, Lyman White essentially started his own sect back down in that area of Texas. And they built a temple, and they had all of these incredible visionary experiences down there. So it clearly didn't die with Joseph in that sense. It moved down with Lyman White, this sect that interesting, you know, that they moved back down to this peyote region and were having similar type visionary experiences that we are arguing are psychedelic experiences with Joseph. So it's very likely that Joseph had access to something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And again, it could just be a variety of stuff too, right? I mean, that's the problem with all this stuff, and it doesn't get written down, or it's esoteric knowledge that wasn't properly passed down, or, you know, missing links in that chain, or whatever the case may be. But yeah, I mean, it's you get that with a lot of stuff, you know, whether you're looking into like Soma or the Kekion from the Eleusinian Mysteries. Yeah, we can speculate all day. They still don't. I mean, how they still don't know how you would separate the neurotoxic aspects of, you know, if there was ergot in, as part of Kekion, like how would you separate the psychoactive components from the neurotoxic? And that's the problem, right? So I don't know. Lots of stuff to consider and think about. But most of all, though, I think you guys did an amazing job on the documentary. Is that what I saw? Was that completely done and you're just waiting to kind of put it out there, or are you still doing stuff to it?
Yeah, that's what it is for now. I mean, I haven't watched it for probably like 4 weeks, and there are a couple of things in my mind that have come up since. I'm like, I gotta check that scene out. I might want to change that shot right there. That's it for now. I mean, there might be a shot that's replaced here or there, timing of something. We technically have a song we shouldn't use in the closing credits that we gotta check before we show it in public. But that is 99.5% the version that you're going to see if you get tickets and you come to Salt Lake April 27th through 29th, or in Portland May 11th. So
we're also talking about maybe doing an online showing of it for people who aren't local to Salt Lake and Portland.
Yeah, so we
I recommend that too. I mean, even if you do it separately from that whole thing as like a separate event or whatever, and let me know too. I'll try and get the word out, or you guys can come back on for, you know, a short thing or promote it or whatever. Let me know and I'll spread the word any way I can.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, we really appreciate that. Yeah, it's been great chatting with you. I want to say, by the way, you've dropped like 5 or 6 names that you've had conversations with in this episode. I'm like, oh, who do you have access to? Like, where are you pulling these people from?
Dude, Brandon, I told you, this is why I love this podcast.
Like, MK Ultra, bro. No, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, I I'm interested in all this stuff. I'm kind of like an autodidact. I'm not writing books. I mean, maybe I will at some point about my own kind of stuff, but this is just a podcast. I'm just really interested in these topics. I really love origins of things and finding out the mystery and looking into the mysteries of life, death, you know, psychology, the mind, all that kind of stuff. So this is just, you know, it's a passion of mine. And I think when I reach out to people, I tell them, hey, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, that's what it is. But I appreciate that. And I think the people that we've had on are super knowledgeable. I like to think that we've done a good job cultivating the knowledge on these topics on this podcast, so people aren't kind of getting fed the BS or the stuff that's like way out there, the complete woo stuff, which is fun to listen to once in a while. But I don't, you know, you can't go too hard into it. But yeah, man, I appreciate it. And you guys are welcome on the show anytime. You know, I'm doing the show once or twice a week usually. So, like I said, feel free if you guys want to come back on before or promote it after you've done your events or whatever. Shoot me a message. We'll try and set it up. And I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and letting me take a look at it, because I do think you did a great job. And as somebody who's made their own documentary now, I kind of know how hard it is to do, number one. And number two, like the editing process and everything. It's just to put something out there that's coherent, that makes sense. And you guys did a good job of like having, like I said, the beginning, the background story, and then coming in with the hypothesis and working off of that. So kudos to you.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I'd love to be on again, you know, with the group to promote it in some form or just have a follow-up conversation. This has been really good.
Yeah, thank you for having us on.
Sweet, man. Yeah, thank you. And yeah, Alex, again, you're welcome on anytime as well. And yeah, check out their documentary when it comes out, Entheomagus. And I will put the link once Alex sends me a message. I'll put the link for the paper down below in the show notes and a little bit of more information. So check that out. And if you want to support Mind Escape, the best way to do it is click our Linktree link down below. If you're listening to this on an audio platform, check out our YouTube channel, because we do all of our episodes live. There's no ads or anything on that. However, once the episode's over, there will be ads, and there'll be ads on Spotify. We do have video episodes on Spotify, though, too, so check that out. And check out our documentary, As Within, So Without, From UFOs to DMT. The link is down below as well. And I think that's it. We're going to wrap it up here. Again, thank you to Alex, Brandon, and Cody, who had to drop out. Shout out to Cody. We really appreciate you coming in here as long as you did. And yeah, shout out to everybody that was listening and sending messages out there. We appreciate you as well. And we're going to end it the way we always do, which is we love everybody. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.